Welcome to the Jack Straw Writers Program, a series of live readings and conversations with Pacific Northwest writers, recorded during the spring of 2005 at Jack Straw Productions in Seattle. This year's series was curated and hosted by John Mifsud. In this program, we will hear from poet Brenda Givens and novelist Steve Hernandez Effingham. Here's your host, John Mifsud.
Our first reader is Steve Hernandez Effingham. He was born in Queens, New York in 1953. He moved to Los Angeles in 1975 and became fascinated with jazz. Currently, he's working on a historical novel about jazz musicians at the turn of the century in New Orleans. He captures the tension of race relations at the time and blends in the dynamic lives of renowned musicians who shaped our American jazz tradition. We are very fortunate he has chosen to read from his novel this evening. Please help me welcome Steve Hernandez Effingham.
Thank you very much. Thanks to John and Jack Straw. This is an excerpt. The novel is about a particular jazz musician, fictionalized, Jean Kid Auger. Actually, this novel starts in 1965, but we encompass his entire life. This is the year 1900. He's just run away from home and gone to New Orleans to join the great cornetist Buddy Bolden. 14-year-old Jean Auger runs away to the city in search of Buddy Bolden and finds him on Franklin Street as two brass bands battle, only to lose him in the crowd. July 22, 1900, New Orleans, Louisiana. Jean zigzagged through the procession of longshoremen and into the ranks of the brass band. The musicians wore military hats with the word Onward on the front and jackets with rows of brass buttons and plush epaulets. The leader of the band stood to the side holding a cornet. He was a short, light-skinned man with thick, wavy hair sticking out from under his hat. "Manuel Perez is the greatest cornet in the world," shouted a boy, pointing at the leader of the Onward. "Hell, he is," shouted someone else. "King Bolden is the greatest." Perez walked backwards, facing the band, holding his cornet in his left hand and motioning with his right as he shouted, "Number 37," and each man paged through a booklet clipped to a tiny music stand attached to his instrument. Perez nodded to the Grand Marshal, a tall, thin black man wearing a white military uniform with gold stripes on the pants, gold buttons on his coat, gold epaulets on his shoulder, and a tall hussar's hat. He blew two piercing whistle blasts, signaling the drummers to start. The rest of the band readied their instruments, watching Perez for the cue, which he gave with a downward motion of his horn. Everyone blew simultaneously into a blaring military march, stepping in unison. The crowd gasped at the band's precision, following as they moved down Perdido Street. Scores of children marched mock military struts on the side of the street, everyone marveling at the band's abrupt exactness, cutting to the military rhythm as if the men were a single individual. Jean was soaked with sweat and still felt a chill at the sight of the Onward. He'd never seen black men marching so brazenly, shoulder to shoulder, the music brash, bold, and loud as they careened down the streets of the white city. As far as Jean knew, all cities must be white cities. Yet what moments before was a white street in a white city transformed beneath the feet of the Onward as black faces emerged from the crowd. Workers stopped working, and men and women pushed to the side of the street and cheered as the children ran alongside their procession. Even some white people stopped, gaping at the bright military colors flashing and at the machine-like precision of the band. Jean thought, maybe New Orleans ain't just the white man's town. He ran alongside the Onward, trailing next to a trombonist, a tall, gaunt man with broad shoulders. Jean traveled half a block, looking straight up, cackling at the man's slide slicing the sky, when suddenly his body collided with another body and he went down in the street. "Damned nigger," a man shouted, shaking his fist. Jean felt a hand gripping his forearm like a vice and twisting it behind his back. Someone was trying to drag Jean towards a white-haired old man wearing a white suit and wielding a cane. "I got the little coon, Major Hersey," he shouted. "Why in God's name do these people persist in marching?" screamed the old man in the white suit. "I don't know, Major," replied the man holding Jean. "We shoot 'em, we hang 'em, we took their goddamn vote away." The old man in the white suit breathed heavily, wiping sweat from his bright red face with a handkerchief. and they still act like it's the high days of nigger domination," he shouted. He thrust his cane forward, measuring the distance to Jean's skull. "Someone call the officer," came a voice, "and take that darky to jail." "It's intolerable," shouted the old man, and the man holding Jean yelled, "Damned niggers," turning towards the procession and shaking his fist as Jean broke away. He crouched as he ran, ducking into the ranks of the onward, darting through to the other side of the street and jogging alongside the Grand Marshal. The drums thundered and the brass shot jagged thrusts of lightning. The Grand Marshal leaned his long frame to the right, strutting at the head of the parade, as though he intended to take the band right on Franklin Street, taking long strides that way, but instead he made a hard left as the throng of children following the band sailed off in the wrong direction. The onward flew around the corner, and the people crowding the sidewalk laughed and cheered as the kids chased back. Then the band halted about a half a block from Poydras, near the train station, playing "A Long Way to Tipperary" to a slashing up-tempo beat amidst hundreds of people dancing and shouting, until all at once the music stopped. Perez removed his cap and ran his fingers through his hair, then yelled to the bass drummer, who began pounding out a Cuban rhythm. Perez calmly placed his hat back on, raised his horn to his mouth, and in a great, animated gesture, blew. The band was off on a dime, in unison, Perez swinging his horn as he played, the drummer playing faster, and the musicians clicking into the increased tempo. They seemed to tear the music out of the air. Jean danced in a crowd of boys and girls on the side of the street, head down, arms up, as he stepped to the beat, oblivious to the angry whites shoving past. He shook and stomped, flailing his arms like a dervish, then stopped, cocking his ears and standing limply amongst the gang of kids. He'd been moving to a rhythm different from what the band was playing, and for a moment thought it must be a trick, like the Grand Marshal making the children go in the wrong direction. Jean tried to feel the beat, but his body was torn between two separate rhythms. He heard two tunes coming from the band and was sure it was some kind of stunt. He stopped dancing again and strained to hear. Two tunes! The second tune growing louder. Jean was sure of it. "Who's playing Didn't He Ramble?" someone shouted. "It must be a funeral," said a man. "Somebody must have died. Look yonder." A woman pointed, and Jean looked towards the throng of black people filling the side of the street ahead on the corner of Poydras, waiting for the onward to pass. They turned in a wave down Franklin, exploding into cheers at something out of Jean's view. Jean sprinted towards Poydras as the raucous, bittersweet strains of Didn't He Ramble rang clear and loud. Just as he made the corner, another brass band, followed by a large crowd and hundreds of dancing children, swung onto Franklin Street. "It's the Excelsior," someone shouted. "It's Professor Bequay's band." The Excelsior moved in loose formation, collars open, jackets off, hats pushed back, blowing like mad for a chaotic rabble of dancers. And they weren't reading music as they played. Each man was blowing freely, like Buddy Bolden, the tuba chopping bass beats, the clarinet wailing and skittering, the trombones roaring and moaning, and the cornet soaring in the center, blasting high notes. Professor Bequay walked to the side of the Excelsior, carrying a little conductor's stick, shaking his head derisively as he watched the band freestyling to the dancers. When he noticed the onward on the street, his head jerked like a lion suddenly aware of an interloper. He signaled a grand marshal, whose whistle blast snapped the drummers into a martial beat. The crack of the drum echoed in the street, causing the wild jamming to cease and the Excelsior to ready their horns. The maze of buildings on Franklin reverberated with booming drums. Jean could hear Bequay barking at the Excelsior. The musicians tightened their ranks, marching directly towards the onward. Meanwhile, the onward punched out hot ensemble passages. The bell of Perez's horn, tilted slightly higher than the rest, signaled with subtle slowing movements that caused the unit to change sonic directions, slashing against the din of street noise. Professor Bequay nodded to his snare drummer, who set off in a rhythm slightly slower than the onward drummer, followed by the Excelsior's bass, who clenched his jaw as he whipped the drum. Then Bequay raised his conductor stick, slashing the air, and the Excelsior was off, marching, each step calibrated to the drum beat, coming to a stop a few yards away, directly facing the onward. The two bands worked face to face, wailing separate songs as hundreds of supporters cheered, some dancing to one band, some dancing to the other, some dancing to both, everyone stomping, spinning, dipping, and jumping on the concrete bed of Franklin Street. Jean stood amidst the throng and thought he heard every note from every instrument as the two bands played and played, neither missing a beat or a note or losing focus in the face of the other band's blasting. And almost simultaneously, Perez and Baquet signaled their respective grand marshal. Each blew his whistle, and the bands moved forward into each other's ranks. The shrill screech of the grand marshal's whistles were lost in the chaos, but each band somehow responded to the command to march in place within the ranks of the other, playing with impenetrable concentration, chorus after chorus, each unit thrusting blocks of sound at the enemy, brilliantly colored geometric shapes juxtaposed in the air, layer after layer reverberating, and the mass of humanity encircling the Onward and the Excelsior motionless, all the dancers down to the smallest child frozen as the sound became visible, a rainbow of smashed glass spraying from the brass bells and the drums vibrating the breast of every living thing on Franklin. Then Baquet and Perez must have motioned to their grand marshals, and the grand marshals must have blown the signal, because each band suddenly moved off with crisp metallic strides that caused gasps and cries from the crowd. They advanced in opposite directions, as though they never even encountered one another. The crowd seemed to exhale collectively as they broke away. After several moments of dead silence, the crowd awoke, surprised, rising to wild cheering and applause. Jean felt his body released as the bands uncoupled, and as the space between the two bands opened, exposing the people on the other side of Franklin moving again, countless arms waving, hands gesticulating, heads turning, torsos twisting and stepping. Jean's eyes fell on two men, stationary on the sidewalk in the center of the animated crowd, motionless amidst the giddy bliss of the people. His eyes darted between the two faces as all around people chattered about the meeting of the Onward Brass Band and the Excelsior Brass Band. "You don't see that too often," someone shouted. "The Onward blinked first. No, it was sure enough was a draw. Like hell, the Excelsior couldn't stand the heat." Jean's eyes were riveted on the two men conversing as the crowd melted into workaday New Orleans. The traffic pushed in from both directions, closing like a curtain on the two men, as Jean's eyes stopped finally on the face of the younger man. Buddy Bolden. Jean's mind clicked. Just like that, there was Bolden, directly across the street. And just like that, he disappeared behind a wall of horses, wagons, and streetcars. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Hernandez-Effingham, reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. Our program continues with Brenda Givens. Once again, curator John Mifsud.
Our next reader is Brenda Givens, who is a storyteller informed by tales from Africa and the American South. Her latest work in progress is a novel entitled In the Company of His Sisters. Tonight, I am pleased Brenda will be reading from her collection of poetry. For me, they map a range of poignant times and places that call up a distinct concern and invite mindful consideration. Please help me welcome Brenda Givens.
Hello, everybody. This is a birthday gift to someone close to me. Symmetry. So much like paper, she and I began so much like a blank sheet, unremarkable in so many ways. But folding paper is such a natural thing, first once, then again, until shape took form, and soon the mundane paper folding took on origami aspects. Paper became art, the art of symmetry and form, creating something more than me, a metamorphosis into us. And still the folds take on new lineation, overlays so intricate, until we understand the art of origami is a cherished act of patience, designing the delicate mystery of you and I. Lessons in anger, sticks and stones. Can't say when. Must have been about the beginning of time a wedding took place. Hate met ignorance. Formed a loathsome union. I met their son when I was 5. He wasn't much, just a word. 1,000 words had gone before. None so maimin', though. He knocked me down, took from me in one cruel moment. I got up confused and longin', Now in his strange world, colors dulled by hot, futile winds, clouds that never soothe the pleading cracks of earth, green tree muted, blue sky vague. Now, won't dream so easily, won't trust so readily. He never went too far away, hid mostly just around the bend, still knocked me down, but never took from me again. I hear his laughter, sounds of dry gusts blowing. My mama whispered his name, said he had a few. Bigotry, prejudice, racism, angry names. Couldn't pronounce them, even though when I was 5, I understood. And it seems like the world changes, and it doesn't. This next poem is called Welcome to the Neighborhood. It doesn't happen in this day and age, not in our neighborhood. A woman and her daughter walking to the neighborhood coffee shop. Me and Lindsay walking to Tully's, my neighborhood, in Clyde Hill, not far from my house. Running back home to get my punch card, my daughter walked on. In the corner of my eye, a Medina patrol car rolled slowly, stopping me at my house to ask a few questions. Why was I running? Who was the woman I left on the street? What the hell business is it of yours? Odd to see a black woman running in Bill Gates' neighborhood? My neighborhood, on my street. At my house, I pled guilty to living in Clyde Hill running on my street. The officer's neck turned a deeper shade of red, and my apprehension expanded just one more time. Fear, anger, hopelessness, my feelings shared by my children in my neighborhood. This next poem I'm going to read is a poem that took me a long time to write, and it is in remembrance of James Byrd Jr., a man who was dragged in Jasper, Texas in 1998. It's called Dust Storm. A quiet street in the early a.m. Nights in Jasper move in dull cadence. Chains laying in the truck bed with no white sheets to cover them up and no sentry to sound the alarm. Signs of the dust storm coming. Ain't no time for a black man to be on Highway 96. Fear just a word. Terror just a feeling. Fly away, far away from here, bird. Crusted brown leaves can't retell a backwoods lynching. He was crouched against the fist and boot, losing his life to someone's perverted way of thinking, crying to the moon which had turned blood red. Scream out loud for what's coming next takes away all that's proud. Pavement smoking with the friction, flesh eaten by asphalt, measuring pain in miles and minutes taken on the guise of eternity. Mercy long since covered her eyes and justice gone to sleep. Hunting for the night coon, rag doll flopping, bursting through seams. Death comes soon. So much grime on this 82 Ford, the kind that can't never be washed off. History blown about on some vigilante gust. And this four-wheeled weapon, this hellish rig, drags its wretched victim while they hoop and holler to the sounds of bones cracking. Formulated plan set to ignite. Baptism into the Brotherhood on Independence Day, but opportunity came early that June night. Which would James Byrd choose if he was to rise again? Severed arm with exposed shoulder dangling, or down the road a piece? His head so disfigured his mama wouldn't recognize it. Or maybe what's left of his fleshless torso, no cooling board for him to lie in peace while they mourn his loss. Monstrous deeds by three white men, pure evil, in the mind of this man king. No shred of royal, no sign of regal. John William King, 65% of your body covered in loathing, permanent tattooed scars in your flesh, surface reminders of a rotted soul etched in ink. Now, who's the colored one? Now, who's the hunted one? Wind keeps blowing. Dust won't settle on this strip of road, 'cause the hate just growing and growing and growing. And this last poem I'm going to read is about flowers and about a specific kind of flower that I think I'd like to be. It's one of my favorite flowers. I think I'd like to have a few of these around. It's called Sunflower Fields. Eye towards the heavens, defying delicacy. Broad, firm stem barely supports this blossom. So unlike its sister, the rose or the iris, who would stop to stroke its petals? I stand in awe of golden meadows. Alone, it is commanding. None dare doubt its presence in the bouquet. A field of these cyclops blooms stifles words, conjuring Van Gogh outside the canvas. Each afternoon they pray as one, then bow to moon and stars. Poets might compare woman to the violet or the daisy, but measure me within the nobleness of the sunflower. Thank you.
Brenda Gibbons' reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. These readings and interviews were recorded at Jack Straw Productions during the spring of 2005 as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program and co-produced for radio with 94.9 KUOW Seattle. The curator of this year's program was John Mifsud. Audio engineer and producer for radio was Scott Bartlett. The program's manager was Steve Peters. The executive director of Jack Straw Productions is Joan Rabinowitz. The Jack Straw Writers Program is made possible with support from the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation for the Arts, the Brenneman Jake Foundation, Arts Fund, the Mayor's Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs, the For Culture King County Lodging Tax Fund, the Washington State Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, Humanities Washington, and individual contributors. Support for radio production provided by Clark Neuber, Certified Public Accountants and Consultants. Original music provided by Jack Straw Artist-in-Residence, Ela Lamlin. All of the writers heard in this series are published in Volume 9 of the Jack Straw Writers Anthology and featured online in the Jack Straw Writers Forum at jackstraw.org. To purchase a copy of the anthology or for more information about Jack Straw Productions or the Jack Straw Writers Program, please contact us by phone at 206-634-0919 or visit us at www.jackstraw.org. Thanks for listening.